I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, an update on transportation issues in Baltimore and beyond. A plan to widen the Washington Beltway and I-270 has drawn criticism around cost, effectiveness, and equity. Catherine Shaver of the Washington Post and Brian O'Malley of the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance discussed the proposal. And with fares on Baltimore buses, the light rail, and the subway scheduled to increase by 10 cents a ride on Sunday, an assessment of the Baltimore Link system, which has now been in place for 2 years. Kevin Quinn is the CEO and administrator of the Maryland Transit Administration. Samuel Jordan is the president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. Klaus Philipson is a Baltimore architect, urban designer, and transportation planner. Ryan Dorsey is a member of the Baltimore City Council. They join me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us today. Today we're going to have a look at transit and transportation in the Baltimore and Washington region. In April, Michelle Porcio resigned as the city's director of transportation here in Baltimore amid reports that morale at the $207 million agency was low. And Isabel Mercedes Cumming, the city's inspector general, was undertaking a wide-ranging review of the agency. Last Thursday, Ms. Cumming issued a synopsis of a report in which she did not mention morale. She did, however, identify a manager who's no longer with the department who had committed time and attendance fraud. It appears that this manager, whom she did not name, spent at least 4 workdays driving for a ride-sharing service while he claimed he was working for the city. Michelle Porcio was replaced by an interim DOT director, Frank Murphy. We invited Mr. Murphy to join us today, but he was unavailable. 2 years ago tomorrow, the Maryland Transit Administration revamped the bus system in Baltimore and introduced Baltimore Link to area riders. And at that time, we spoke with MTA officials and transportation advocates about the system's rollout and efficacy, and we followed up with them a few months later. So today, once again, we're going to take a look at the system's performance and at some of its new features. But we'll begin with a conversation about Governor Larry Hogan's controversial traffic relief plan in the Washington suburbs. Catherine Shaver is a staff writer for the Washington Post, where she covers transportation and development issues, and she joins us on the line from Washington. Katie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what does this plan to relieve traffic in the Washington burbs entail?
Well, the governor announced in September 2017 that he wanted to build express toll lanes on both Interstate 270 and the Capitol Beltway. So under the governor's plan, he would build up to 4 toll lanes on each highway, and he would pay for all of it through public-private partnerships that he says would be the largest in the entire country. Instead of using money from the state's transportation trust fund, which he says they don't have any money to spend on this, they would have teams of private companies design the lanes, build them, finance their construction, and operate them long-term in exchange for collecting most of the toll revenues over 50 years.
And so the cost of this project has been estimated somewhere between $9 and $11 billion. So how is that cost absorbed? Who absorbs what?
Well, and it's hard to say how much this actually will end up costing, because that estimate of $9 to $11 billion is only for part of it. And again, that's just the state's estimate. We won't know how much it would cost until the contracts are finalized. But the idea is that the private sector would finance and pay for all of the lane's construction in exchange for collecting most of the toll revenues and getting the profits for them long term. The state would get some of the toll revenues to subsidize construction of some of the less profitable sections of the highway.
And you wrote a piece about a meeting that happened with the Board of Public Works earlier this month on the 5th of June. It was a long meeting, about 3 hours. And right at the very end of the meeting, the governor sort of threw a wrench into the works to a certain degree. What happened at that point in that meeting?
Yeah, it was really interesting, because for almost 2 years now, MDOT has been saying they need to build the toll lanes on the Capitol Beltway first, because they need to use some of the toll revenues from that very lucrative section of highway to subsidize construction for the toll lanes on upper I-270. And then after this 3 hours of discussion, at the last minute, The governor said, you know what, there's so much opposition to building these lanes on the Beltway. We're going to do I-270 first. And it really did throw everybody for a loop. I mean, those of us who've been following the issue for months left the meeting scratching our heads and looking at each other and saying, what just happened? So it really was, you know, a big change of course. Since then, we've heard that the governor wants to build the toll lanes on the lower portion of I-270 first, because that would throw off the most toll revenue to subsidize construction for the lanes on upper 270. The problem is some of the worst traffic backups are on upper 270. So there are a lot of folks, and including some opponents to these toll lanes, who say, you know, is the state really building these lanes for the public good in terms of relieving the worst traffic congestion the soonest, or are they building it to profit the private sector the most?
And I guess there are precedents for this. There are parts of the Beltway in Virginia that already have toll lanes. How are those working? How have they been received? Are they living up to financial expectations?
Well, the toll lanes on Virginia's part of the Beltway and I-95 have been well received. I mean, the surveys show that folks don't use them every day because the tolls can be anywhere from about $5 to $15 or so. They're the kind of things that people use once in a while when they really have to get somewhere quickly and buy their way out of congestion, you know, when they're trying to get to that important work meeting or they're trying to get to the airport. The more controversial toll lanes in our area, however, are on I-66 inside the Beltway, and those opened more recently. They did not add any new capacity when they tolled those lanes. Those were lanes that previously only carpools could use, and then when they added the tolls, they said, okay, if you're not in a carpool, you can still use these lanes, you just have to pay for them. So they didn't widen the highway. Because of that, there's very limited capacity, and the tolls have been as high as $45 or so during the peak morning time. And because of that, those toll lanes have gotten a very bad rap in our region. MDOT says these lanes would be different because they would add more capacity. So MDOT says, we're not going to have $45 tolls on these. But the opponents say, how do we know that? We have no idea at this point what the tolls could be.
There's a survey being done of people who hold easy passes, who use these various roads that are under consideration for expansion and toll lanes. It's being conducted by Resource Systems Group. And there's a criticism of the poll that they're taking to gauge people's interest in whether or not they'd be willing to pay extra and how much, et cetera, and that it doesn't give anybody any other options for relieving traffic. You wrote earlier this month about the idea of a monorail on Interstate 270, which might be part of a traffic relief study. Who's advocating for that, and what's the status of that?
That idea has come from a private developer in Montgomery County named Bob Isinger and some of his friends. And they say that for about $3 billion, you could build a 27-mile monorail between Frederick and the Shady Grove Metro Station. And a lot of people, when they hear the word monorail, kind of, you know, tisk and roll their eyes and say, this is something from, you know, a Simpsons episode, or this is something out of Disney World. And so it didn't really seem to gain a lot of traction. But more recently, when the state started focusing on I-270, a lot of the opponents to the highway toll plans who've been saying they want more transit instead, a lot of them started saying, well, wait a minute, this doesn't sound so crazy anymore. We could build a monorail. That's the amount of, I mean, that's the kind of expanded transit that people want to see, and why not at least study it? So during this June 5th Board of Public Works meeting, the board also did approve something to say, let's look at monorail more closely.
Katie Shaver is a staff writer for The Washington Post. She covers transportation and development. Katie, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We turn now to Brian O'Malley. He is the president and CEO of the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance. Brian, welcome back to Midday.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So you oppose the governor's idea of toll lanes and expanding 270 and 495, the Washington Beltway. Why?
We oppose the way it's being done right now. We're at an important decision point here as a state. We can, you know, we've seen in the past 6 years or so when we widen highways that we see farmland convert to asphalt and cul-de-sac type development, which leads to people driving more. It also leads to water pollution and air pollution, and it leads to centrally located neighborhoods and the people who live in them suffering. And so we're seeing ourselves as another fork in the road, and we don't think we should continue to repeat the same patterns.
And listeners, I apologize, we're having a little trouble with Brian O'Malley's phone line, but we'll keep our fingers crossed that it'll stay stable for us. In terms of, you wrote a letter to the Board of Estimates a few days ago, I guess a few weeks ago, when was it, the beginning of the month. You mentioned fiscal responsibility, its actual effectiveness, the environmental impacts, and inequity. In terms of the equity piece of this, this is something that's of big concern to your coalition, given how expensive, and Katie Shaver was just talking about how sometimes some of these toll roads, you know, can charge surcharges of like up to $45 to get from point A to point B. Talk about your concerns in that regard.
Sure. Well, we've seen, for NPR reported recently that Black and Hispanic Americans tend to live in neighborhoods with more pollution of all kinds, including air pollution from transportation. And this plan is going to disproportionately improve mobility for higher-income people and those with private automobiles. So, you know, the proposed projects are going to exacerbate the same patterns that have left neighborhoods cut off from economic opportunity, suffering high unemployment, entrenched poverty, disinvestment, and a disproportionate share of the health impacts from pollution. So it's an unfair prioritization of how we use our transportation dollars.
The governor and others often tout the advantages of these public-private partnerships. The governor's plan includes, you know, private companies running these toll lanes, et cetera. You have some concerns about that. You say that public-private partnerships can have some inherent dangers. What are those?
Well, first of all, we should be very clear that Marylanders are going to pay for this one way or another. Sometimes when some officials talk about public-private partnerships, they speak as if it's free money, that someone's giving us the money to do this. And I think when we pause to think about it, of course that's not happening. But sometimes it sounds that way, and they sort of talk about it as if it's that way. We're borrowing money. We're putting it on the credit card. And these entities that are going to bid on the project intend to make a profit for their investors. And so they're going to recoup their investment. So they'll make an initial investment to build the toll facilities, widen the roads, and then they'll collect tolls or get payments from the state. And they're going to try to structure the contract to minimize their risk and maximize their profits, which is fine. That's how the private sector works. But what's not fine is if our public officials are so eager to sort of score political points in the near term that they are sloppy with the details going into the contract. And so we need people to look very closely and make sure that we negotiate the best possible deal for Maryland and aren't in such a rush to just get something signed and announced and then leave it to future governors and future administrations to deal with the consequences.
Just have about a minute left, Brian, but the governor and supporters of this plan note that Maryland has the second highest commuting time in the country. More than 240,000 people get stuck on I-95, sitting in 7 hours of congestion every day. More than 260,000 people get stuck on I-270. What is the answer? What approach should we be taking?
Well, first I'll say widening these highways will make that continue to get worse. We've doubled the lane miles of highways from 1982 to 2012, and traffic got five times worse. So that's the recipe for continuing those problems. To do better, we need to do a combined approach of investing in public transportation options and land use planning to encourage jobs and housing near places with walkability, with transit alternatives, so that we're not required to get in the car for every single trip in our daily lives.
Well, Brian O'Malley, that's all the time we have for this segment, but I appreciate your input, and thanks very much. We'll be in touch.
Thanks for having me on.
Brian O'Malley is the president and CEO of the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance. Coming up, we shift our focus to Baltimore area transit issues. Kevin Quinn of the Maryland Transit Administration, Samuel Jordan of the Baltimore Transit Equity Alliance, and the urban planner Klaus Philipson join us after this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're turning now to issues affecting Baltimore area public transit users. Kevin Quinn joins us. He's the head of the Maryland Transit Administration, the agency that oversees the region's bus and rail lines and the Baltimore subway. Good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Samuel Jordan joins us as well. He's the president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. That's a group that came together to promote Baltimore's Red Line subway project. And since the Red Line's cancellation by Governor Hogan, the coalition has been advocating for other city transit improvements. Sam Jordan, good to have you back as well.
Thank you so much.
And we're also joined by the architect Klaus Philipson. He's a Baltimore-based architect at Archplan Incorporated. He's also an urban design and transportation planner and the author of Baltimore, Reinventing an Industrial Legacy City. Klaus, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
So listeners, we invite you to join our conversation this hour. Let us know how the region's transit system is working for you. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Kevin Quinn, let me start with you. 2 years ago, tomorrow, you launched Baltimore Link, and you three were on to talk about it then. So how's it been going in the last 2 years? What's your assessment of its efficacy and success so far?
Yeah, things have been going really well. We've had a lot going on the last 2 years. So a couple things. So one, we focused a lot on technology. When I came in a couple years ago, a little before the launch, I said, let's focus on technology. We got to focus on technology and really moving as an agency driven by anecdote to an agency driven by data. And so, a few things that we did. One, we installed GPS units on all of our 750 buses in our bus fleet. And that was really important. That gave us real-time GPS data that we then rolled out through the transit app to all of our riders. That's been downloaded about 100,000 times, 175,000 times by our riders. That's been really important. So not only externally does that give our riders the data and predictive arrival times of when the bus is going to come, it also gives us internal data to build better schedules. And so that's been really critical for us. So, just this past February was one of our most important schedule changes in the agency's history. And we used real-time data for the first time to build our bus schedules. So what we've seen is a Baltimore Link 2 years ago, on-time performance in the 50s. We were around 58-59%. We sit today at around 72%. So we've made some great strides. We've still got a ways to go. We're still going to get that number up, but we've made some big improvements with that.
Have the schedule changes represented a fairly significant change from what you began with? I mean, obviously, you were speculating. You made a lot of changes when Baltimore Link was announced. I mean, you canceled a lot of routes and changed, a lot of things. Have you changed it fairly dramatically since then?
We a lot of it was add a little time here, take a little time away there. And in some cases, we did do some dramatic changes. But what we saw was, I think it was about 23 of our routes saw improvements of 5% or more, with the average route seeing about 4.5% change. That's really good. That's really good change. In transit systems, change comes very incrementally. And so we're going to keep working at it. We've got a schedule change coming up for June at the end of this month, where we're also taking a look at the real-time data for every single one of our bus routes and tweaking those schedules again, because we're going to get that performance higher.
And Sam Jordan, your organization represents folks who take the bus and the subway and the light rail every day or many days. What's your impression?
Well, thank you, Tom. Our impression is, with respect to the launch of the Link, that the Link was launched before it was ready. But first, let me tell you just a bit about the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. We are the only group that has been consistently demanding the completion of the Red Line since it was canceled in June 25, 2015. When the governor exercised his right, perhaps his authority, but he pledged his allegiance to Baltimore's segregationist transportation policy. centuries we've been dealing with this. In fact, most recently, it hasn't improved greatly. We still have a transit system that is not equitable. But we want to go further with that critique because we want to make sure that it's understood our mission first is to build and lead an informed, resolute constituency that will pursue and demand the completion of the Baltimore Light Rail, the Red Line project. Now, what we have found is, one, that in the cancellation of the Red Line, Governor Hogan condemned the Baltimore region to economic decline. In fact, any responsible discussion about transportation in Baltimore over the past 5 years has always referenced the Red Line, and particularly the Red Line's cancellation was a horrific, horrible decision by the governor. And what I mean, when we talk about the economic decline, if you compare what has happened with the cancellation of the Red Line, but he granted approval to the Purple Line, the Purple Line already has over $12 billion in projects committed to that project, to that Purple Line route, while Baltimore, for the next 6 years and beyond, in its TIP, that's the Transportation Improvement Plan, the CDT, the Consolidated Transportation Plan, there's nothing for Baltimore that links transit and development of any value to the city. Baltimore needs massive economic development.
And as a pragmatic and practical matter, though, do you see any movement towards reviving the idea of a red line?
Absolutely. In fact, what we're seeing now is more and more people, transit advocates included, as well as policymakers and elected officials, are talking about the very gap that we have now due to the cancellation of the Red Line. In fact, this past session of the legislature demanded that MDOT-MTA study and produce a report on the restart or reinitiation of the Red Line Light Rail project because they were particularly disappointed in the work of the link. In fact, when I say that the link was launched before it was ready, it was launched without an origins and destination study. It was launched without its tech systems in place. It was launched without any real need or any real focus on that 90-minute commute that so many face. Two out of three jobs in Baltimore cannot be reached within 90 minutes. But it also did not address the issue of the impact on the economy of what we call transit detention, when someone is sentenced, frankly, to 3 to 4 hours every day in their commute due to a dysfunctional transportation system. There's a cost to the economy.
I want to pick up on that a little bit later, but back to my original question. In terms of the last 2 years, when the link was introduced and the routes were introduced, and then they've, as Kevin Quinn has just said, you know, they've been revamped a little bit. Do you think it has improved? Has the link gotten better in terms of the rider experience? I mean, if these problems are endemic and systemic to a system that was never designed to alleviate them, if you talk about the length of commuting times and stuff, what's the experience of riding the bus, the subway, and the light rail been like in the last 2 years? Has it gotten any better?
There were overwhelming responses from riders in the first several weeks of the link being launched. They were disappointed. They were upset. People were losing their jobs.
Has it gotten better since then?
I can't say that it's gotten much better, Tom, because we get reports from people who still can't get that last mile, for example. You would think that would be one of the first things addressed. They can't get to work. You know, it's one thing to say that we have access to transportation and a bus stop in front of our door, but you can't get that last 2 miles to your job. You don't have access. So we're looking at an issue with respect to what it takes to get people to fight back. We don't have to accept the governor's condemnation of Baltimore based on race-based transit policy. You see, we've fought in this past 2 years. You can tell what has happened here, for example, in, let's say, Anne Arundel County. We have public officials leading what's called a dog whistle ban to shut down light rail service in Anne Arundel County. In Baltimore County, at White Marsh, after a melee there in August, the same thing. The reflexive approach was to limit and or shut down public transportation. Now, what we want to say with this before you go is that public transportation is race-conflicted everywhere people of color live in this nation. We want to bring that to Baltimore's attention because until we address that, Baltimore will not have a modern public transportation system that's equitable, reliable, and fast.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin Quinn, before we go to Klaus Phillipson, is there any notion, is there any movement at all towards something like the Red Line that, as you know, Sam Jordan has said, the governor cashiered a long time ago. What's your take on the prospects for that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we're in the process right now. We've started this Regional Transit Plan Commission, which I'm sure we're going to get into, which is going to set a new transportation vision for the region. We sit today with new job centers out there, more data than we've ever had before to create that vision. And just to respond to Mr. Jordan real quick, you know, I would respectfully, you know, disagree that things haven't got better. I think that every transit advocate would agree that, in, you know, putting in place 5.5 miles of dedicated bus lanes to get our buses through downtown faster is important. I think every transit advocate would say installing transit signal priority on every single one of our buses and communicating with traffic signals for the first time ever is really important. And we've seen those travel time savings in reports that we've issued on dedicated bus lanes. And we've seen those improvements in transit signal priority in real time. All of these things that we've done that were part of Baltimore Link, I stand by the fact that it has made the bus system better.
All right, Klaus Phillipson, you study this. You've taken a look at this. You were a big advocate for the Red Line, obviously, some years ago and have been for a long time. But what's your take on how the system, the Link system, is working in terms of what it was promised and what it's delivering?
Well, there are these incremental progress, but, you know, obviously people are never satisfied with their transit system, and the reliability factors, as Kevin said, could still go better. What I wanted to do is put this a little bit in a bigger context and also tie it in with your first segment. So we have a situation where we are talking about climate change and transportation, mobile sources, transportation is the largest contributor to climate change. We are right before a huge transportation revolution with drastic change on all levels, including transit. And we have increasing congestion and crash numbers for pedestrians and bicyclists in particular. And we have huge inequities. And so at this time, we are in a situation where the governor talks only about widening roads, and there is not a single transit project in the Baltimore region on the books to grow the system. At the same time, we are losing riders. Like, the Metro has lost in the last 12 years half of its riders. It was once 50,000, and there are now 25,000 riders on it. And the reason is that the rail system isn't a system. It's three independent rail lines that would have become a system through the Red Line. So the Red Line has...
So you're talking about the interconnectedness between the subway, right, the light rail, and the bus system.
So you can ride, you can have on a transit system 50,000 riders per hour. And we have it not, we have half of that for the whole day. Why is that? Part of it is that the Metro was in disrepair. They're working on this, and it was not reliable as it used to be. But part of it is that it is not in a system. And the third part of that is that the land use is such that around each metro station, you have a hole in the donut instead of the highest density of uses. But so when we are in this situation and we are looking at how our Link system is performing, we need to keep that larger context. And the good news for Baltimore is that the transit system isn't as amoebic as we many people make it. So the transit coalition, that transit foundation that checks nationwide what the various cities do in terms of transit, gave Baltimore an 8.4 score. It's on rank 9 nationally when it comes to walkability and access to transit and frequency of service. So Baltimore is number 26 in size. I have said this before, and APTA, the American Public Transit Association, they measure this also, and Baltimore there ranks on number 11 out of, when we are in size, 26. So we do have a substantial amount of transit on the ground. We just need to make it work better. And
Klaus Philipson is an architect and an urban planner. His latest book is called Baltimore Reinventing an Industrial Legacy City. Samuel Jordan is the president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. Kevin Quinn is the head of the Maryland Transit Administration. We're talking about transportation here on Midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. And you can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. I want to turn to the phones now to Ryan Dorsey. He is a Baltimore City Councilman who represents the 3rd District here in Baltimore. Councilman Dorsey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk in particular about the Maryland Department of Transportation. There's been a leadership change there. We now have an interim director. We have an initial sort of a summary of a report that Isabel Cumming, the inspector general, is slated to release in more detail sometime a little bit later. What's your take on what's going on with the Baltimore DOT?
The Baltimore Department of Transportation is definitely in a fairly anemic state. There are far too people in-house to be able to plan and execute the kind of projects that would be transformative to neighborhoods and make our transit system work better, make our streets safer. There are far too employees in there able to do that kind of work, and that's because we've had just a rapid turnover. We've had a turnover of leadership and no continuity or really even presentation of a vision for the department and how it can really improve transportation access and outcomes for Baltimore City for a number of years now.
Frank Murphy has been appointed the interim director of the DOT. You were certainly no fan of his predecessor, Michelle Porcio. Are you an advocate for Mr. Murphy continuing in a full-time permanent basis?
Well, what I really think is that the department needs to first and foremost evaluate how it should be playing a role in being partners with the MTA and assessing the kind of needs that we've heard here today. It's not necessarily about one person as a director for the department, but it's really about more of a collective vision, like I think we've heard about today. Brian and Klaus both mentioned the need to kind of marry land use with transportation, and like Klaus said, there is plenty of transit on the ground. We just need to make it work better. The Department of Transportation can really play a huge, huge role in that, but taking that role of being a partner to MTA and being a leader along with the Department of Housing and Community Development and the Planning Department of the city is something, in really marrying together land use and transportation is just something that historically has not been done in Baltimore. It's really been about promoting an auto-centric way of getting around the city. And as you heard from Sam Jordan, that has left a significant portion of the population behind, essentially half of the black population in Baltimore City lacking access to vehicles and therefore lacking access to jobs. And, what I really hope is that beyond whoever the director is right at this moment, we're shifting that that kind of global perspective of what kind of city we want to be more dramatically. Right now, our budget in the city, which we just passed, does not exhibit any real leadership on transportation at all.
And Sam Jordan, when Kevin Quinn talks about making the system data-driven rather than anecdote-driven, obviously there's a lot of data about the racial inequities when it comes to how this system was, conceived and the fact that the governor made that decision to can the red line. But in terms of the data that he mentions about the GPS systems being installed on the buses and people being able to track things, I mean, have you seen improvements? Do you think, in fact, that the system is now more data-driven than it had been in the past?
Let me answer this question, Tom, because I think we're sort of putting me in a corner that we're not in. The Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition is not in just the black corner on issues of transportation. What we're citing is the fact that transit equity is a key to prosperity and use and efficiency of the system for the entire region. when we overlook the issue of race-based transit policy, we have doomed the entire system. In fact, that is why Baltimore does not have a modern transportation system. We want to make sure this issue of transit and land use, transit policy and land use, we are adamant about the fact that Baltimore doesn't need just a fast bus from point A to point B. Baltimore needs transportation associated with what we call community enhancing, transit-oriented development. It is not accidental that in the 2 years since the launch of the link, there's not one economic development project, community-based economic development project associated with the Baltimore link whatsoever. Now, we understand that. The mantra in the industry is still development follows rail, buses follow development. But we want to make sure we also emphasize this key, that in that cancellation decision, Governor Hogan has created two regions, one in the decline, the Baltimore region economically, and the other with just growth and prosperity along the Purple Line in Montgomery and Prince George's County. We also want to make it clear that the link was launched while the MDOT and MTA knew that the track conditions along the metro and subway lines were in what's called the black condition. Don't like to say it that often because it means that there should be no rail movement whatsoever. So how was the link launched when the agency itself knew that it was playing Russian roulette with the safety of its drivers and riders? So I want to just make it on this segment that this is clear. One, the Baltimore Red Line project has to be completed because we can't wait 20 or 25 years. When the MDOT MTA did a study for the administration, it did say that there was no real prospect for having a east-west crossing of Baltimore within that period, 20 to 25 years. We know we can't wait. What the Red Line needs now is only this, and I'll just mention it.
Because we had to do it real quick. We got to take
a break. Of course, the money, a new governance structure for funding and the money, and the political will. We're proposing a regional transportation authority so that it gives autonomy to the region and the region's riders can make those decisions pertinent to transportation.
And we will continue our conversation in a bit. Samuel Jordan is the president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. Kevin Quinn, the CEO and administrator of the Maryland Transit Administration, and Klaus Phillipson, a Baltimore architect, urban designer, and transportation planner. After a break, we'll try to get to some of your calls. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org. We are streaming on the Facebook page at WIPR, and you can also drop us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Baltimore City School students are entering their final week of classes. My guest for the hour will be Dr. Sonia Sonalisis, the CEO of the city school system. And looking ahead to Wednesday, a reminder about a special edition of Midday. We'll be broadcasting our program live from the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. Wednesday is Juneteenth, celebrating the end of slavery in the United States, and our topic at the Lewis Museum will be reparations. Dr. Ray Winbush from Morgan State, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist E.R. Shipp, and the acclaimed civil rights attorney Ajoa A. Ayatoro will be my guests, along with Jackie Copeland. She's the director of the Lewis Museum, and you are welcome to join us in the audience at the museum, on the radio, or online. Come to the web to our website, WIPR.org, to find out more. Before we go to a break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 143 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. In February, Jesse Evans succumbed to complications from injuries he suffered in September of 2000 in a shooting at that time. Last week, the city medical examiner ruled Mr. Evans' death was a homicide. He was 47 years old. This past week, police reported that 11 people lost their lives to violence in our city. The identities of all but one of those victims have been released. They are Durrell Brooks, age 37, Terrell Matthews, age 34, Carl Jennings, age 26, Devon Brooks, age 33, Taven Lothar, age 29, Jawan Dukes, age 36, Dwayne Harris, age 26, Tori Palmer, age 28, Devin Taylor, whose age was unknown, and Brandon Silver. He was 22 years old.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking today about transportation challenges in the city of Baltimore and across our region. My guests are Kevin Quinn, the administrator of the MTA, Samuel Jordan, the president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition, and Klaus Philipson. He's a Baltimore architect and urban planner. He blogs at Community Architect. You are welcome to join our conversation. We'll try to get a couple of calls in here. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org and our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page and ping us there. Let's go to the phones to Angela in Pikesville. Angela, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. And I'm actually waiting for the bus in Pikesville, which is half an hour late, which is typical. But I'd like to address one of the issues around revenue. The MTA is raising their rates, I believe, next month.
Sunday.
And this is the second time within, I think, less than 2 years. And rates usually don't increase that quickly. We are dealing with a citizenry that really can't afford to continue to have their rates increase while the MTA leaves its money on the table. There are plenty of mechanisms of collecting your money that are not even being utilized optimally. A lot of the cash collector boxes on the buses are constantly malfunctioning or just don't work. Often the booths at the MTA subway stations are unmanned, so the gates are left open. So people are using the system and not paying. You also have state employees who constantly go back and forth every day, 5 days a week without paying anything for public transportation. They use public transportation completely at no cost.
Okay, Angela, well, thanks for that comment. I appreciate it. Kevin Quinn, the fare increase, which goes into effect on Sunday, is actually, I guess, mandated by the legislature, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So our fares are legislatively mandated for our core service to go up 10 cents sort of per CPI every 2 years on bus, light rail, metro, and our mobility paratransit service.
That's a consumer price index.
That's exactly right, yeah. And so we're seeing a 10 cent increase per the legislation. It goes up every 5 years by $1 on a MARC and commuter bus. So we are legislatively mandated to do that. And then also state employees by law have free transportation. In fact, that was expanded by a law just passed with this General Assembly that opened it up to the University of Maryland system.
What about the state of the fleet? I understand that Baltimore buses break down something like four times more frequently than buses in Boston, for example. Why is that?
Yeah, so I don't know that it's four times as high. I think they break down at a normal rate compared to other cities from what we've seen. We do have some streets in Baltimore that are in need of some repair. And we have locked in bus buys. We're actually spending about $300 million on new buses through 2025. And I'll just add that, and to a point that Klaus made earlier about ridership declines on light rail and metro, I think that this is something that we've heard loud and clear from our riders. And one of the things that we're doing is investing in new vehicles. So, for example, we're spending $400 million to replace our entire metro rail car fleet, brand new vehicles. We're currently spending about $160 million to overhaul our light rail vehicles, completely gut our light rail vehicles and replace with all new insides, all new seating, security, lighting, all that kind of stuff. And so,
what about the tracks that Sam Jordan alluded to, the condition of the tracks of the subway?
Yeah, so the subway is 100% safe. Safety is absolutely our first priority, and we have sunk tens of millions of dollars into the repair of those tracks, getting rid of those black conditions. And so our tracks are in good condition for running service and very safe, and something that we're very much focused on.
We have a number of folks calling in support of the Red Line. Paul sends an email. Ask your guests if any of you have traveled on this line that roughly follows the same trajectory as the canceled Red Line. Starting from Edmondson Village at morning rush hour and school days, the bus is soon at standing room only capacity or worse within a stop or two and stays that way until Lexington Market. It's the same going the opposite direction in the evening. Tim in Mount Washington says, we've been trying to build the independence of our high school age son, encouraging him to take an MTA bus while monitoring route progress with the MTA app, but all too often they are late or zoom by
full or out of service. He will sometimes choose to walk an hour home to Mount Washington rather than wait. It seems to us that's building that's building the next generation of driver rather than transit rider. And Cos Phillipson, this really is a challenge, isn't it?
This East-West line is the transit line that I use when I use transit, which is not always, but as an architect, I often need to get around during the day. And it is what the caller or the writer says, that it is congested inside the bus and outside, partly because of these things that Ryan Dorsey mentioned, that the streets are owned by the city and the buses run on the streets. And as long as we have a transit system that's dominated by what happens on the street with buses, it is tantamount and important that the city and the MTA collaborate on making the buses move on those streets. So we have started building these red bus lanes. That's a good start. But on that route, on Route 40 out, that the red line would have run, there are no red bus lanes, and the signals often don't work properly. And so that the signals work properly is also very important for the buses, that there's room for bus stops. So there's plenty. What happens these days, and what I meant with the transportation revolution earlier, is that the silos of responsibilities, they're all falling down. We need a lot more collaboration, and not only in the city of Baltimore, but also with the region. When you look at how many people have access to transit within half a mile walking distance from their household, then that in Baltimore City, that is 100%. But when you look in at the region altogether, then it drops to below half. And so what works maybe inside the city relatively well doesn't work in the region at all. And that's what this regional transportation plan is about, this regional transit plan that the legislator has mandated that needs to be finished by 2020. It's a huge opportunity for the region to come together and think about all the pieces that are needed across all the silos to make it work.
And Kevin Quinn, just quickly, is that on track to be delivered in 2020?
Yes, it is. It's absolutely on track. We've had a couple great commission meetings so far, and we're really looking at that plan as an opportunity, as Klaus noted, to set the vision for the region.
And Sam Jordan, when it comes to land use and development, you talk about how development follows subways, rail, and then buses follow that.
Development. I mean,
can you identify one or two places that you think are ripe for, you know, the sort of low-hanging fruit in terms of what could be developed in conjunction with transit?
Sure. Well, we're looking at developing and expanding. Standing now in Owings Mills, for example. That's usually a good example because it is a site where transit can be expanded and can be developed along with the transit route. That's why we would keep land use and transit planning together. We want to make sure that the audience knows that we are proposing a regional transportation authority that's very different from a regional transportation plan. A plan is aspirational. A regional transportation authority has enforceable cohesion when the parties are together because they have common transportation objectives. And we want to make sure that that's clear because, you see, we would be getting a very different treatment were we making these decisions here at the regional level. Transportation is lived and experienced at the regional level. Okay, when Kevin Quinn and Ports in February 2018 misrepresented, lied to the legislature that they shut down the system when they knew that the tracks were in bad condition. They knew from in November 2016 from their own consultant. So we want a kind of responsible representation in our decision making that's autonomous from Annapolis, but also lets us develop.
We are running out of time. So, Kevin Quinn, let me give you a quick chance to, in 10 seconds to respond to this notion of a regional authority. Any movement on that?
So I'm not sure. There was a bill that I think was proposed that did not pass the General Assembly to study a regional authority, and so that bill did not pass. But we are absolutely committed to the region and putting some good funding into some great projects that are going to move this region forward.
Excuse me, Tom.
Kevin Quinn, Sam, I'm awfully sorry, but we are out of
we
time.
We proposed that bill, and we got the money for the bill.
Yeah, we're out of time, and we will try to take this up another time. Kevin Quinn from the MTA, Sam Jordan from the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition, and Klaus Phillipson. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Sonia Sonalisis. We want to thank the DIS for supplying lunch. lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner. They serve breakfast on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's coming up after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.